but she couldn't help it. The trickle of jealousy inside her had quickly widened into a raging river. Katie was the one who had promised, the one who followed William Tyr, who killed herself to learn his lessons, and now she was even keeping Jonathan Tyr's secrets as well. Ro hated William Tyr. So why did he get to see? Ro stared at her, his face both angry and hurt. You think I'm lying? I think you're having some sort of delusion. Ro's eyes narrowed. He held out his hand silently, and Katie returned the sapphire, relieved when he tucked it back into the drawer. As the drawer was closing, Katie caught sight of something else there, a dull gleam of unpolished silver, almost circular. And then it was gone. "I'm sorry I wasted your time," Ro said stiffly. "I'll take you back home now." Katie nodded, just as stiffly. She wished she could just walk out, but the idea of going back up through town alone in the dark gave her the jitters. She waited silently as Ro doused the lamp, then followed him out the door. The wind had picked up again, hissing through the pines. Katie's night vision was gone now, and she saw only a black world beyond the timbers of the porch. "The town is darker now," she thought, but didn't know what the thought meant. Ro locked the door of Jenna's shop, and in each movement, Katie sensed the sudden, deep gulf between them. A gulf that had never existed before. They argued sometimes, certainly, but nothing like this. She felt an absurd impulse to take it back, tell him she believed him, but pride wouldn't let her utter the words. What the hell was Ro doing playing with William Tyr's sapphire anyway? He wasn't supposed to know about it. He had said so himself. Crap. At least admit that you're just jealous. Katie grimaced. She could admit it, but not to Ro. She walked faster, overtaking Ro and then passing him, following her breath in the frosted air. She wished she could just not speak to him until morning, when she would surely have calmed down. Why was she so jealous anyway? She was content to be Katie Rice. She didn't need to have magic, to be one of the crossing children with their strange assortment of gifts. It was Ro who couldn't bear to settle for the hand life had dealt him. Ro who wouldn't rest until he brought down William Tyr's entire town. Katie halted. That last thought hadn't been her own, but someone else's. As though there were a stranger inside her head, not Ro, not Tyr, but a third party, a voice she had never heard before. Hearing voices? You're about two steps from crazy. But Katie didn't believe that. She turned to look at Ro, to see whether that voice had been correct, whether she could find destruction in his face. The road behind her was empty. Katie turned in a slow circle. She was at the very edge of the lower bend, just where the road inclined sharply to begin switchbacking the hill toward the center of town. The area was lit with sporadic lamplight, but this only served to highlight the many pools of shadow behind her. On either side, long-weathered buildings creaked and groaned under the assault of the wind. This end of the lower bend was the closest thing to an industrial row that the town could boast. Mr. Edding's forge, Ellen Wycroft's flour mill, the ceramics shop which held 10 potter's wheels and 2 kilns and was open to all via a sign-up sheet, and Mr. Levi's all-purpose art store, full of leads and canvas, homemade paints and plain, well-made oak picture frames. These were good buildings, friendly buildings. but now they leaned and groaned in the darkness, and Katie felt a trickle of unease at how different they were, how easily certainty became uprooted in the dark. Where was Roe? If he was playing a trick on her, she would make him regret it. "Roe?" she called. The wind picked up her voice and carried it. It seemed to slip down the street, around corners and into shadows, places she didn't want it to go. She thought of the graveyard, bones strewn every which way by an animal that thought nothing of tearing into graves and carrying off corpses. Her imagination, so vivid that Mrs. Warren often read her creative writing assignments to the class, was coming to life, sparking and popping. She sensed movement all around her, behind her, in each pool of shadow. "Roe!" she cried out, her voice cracking mid-syllable. She didn't care if they both got caught now. In fact, she would welcome it, welcome some disapproving adult to escort her back up to the town for a talk with Mum about being out after curfew. Ahead of Katie were deep woods, broken only by the almost imperceptible glimmer of the path. She would rather face getting caught than enter those woods alone. "Roe!" she screamed, but the wind grabbed her voice and seemed to shred it to tatters. No one lived down at this end of town. All of the buildings were closed up and empty at night, but that very emptiness seemed suddenly terrible to Katie, a void waiting to be filled. She would never forgive Roe for this, ever. He had snuck past her, taken one of his secret ways through the woods, and now he was probably halfway home, laughing all the way. They both liked to read horror stories, but the stories didn't frighten Roe the way they did Katie. He probably thought nothing of leaving her stranded here in the dark, thought it was a wonderful joke. "Don't you think he knows you better than that?" Yes, he did. Roe knew Katie's imagination, knew that she wouldn't like to be alone in the windy dark. He had done this on purpose. Katie had behaved badly at Jenna's shop, she knew it. She had meant to apologize. But what Roe had done here was deliberate, spiteful. Katie heard something. Beneath the high, cold cry of the wind, her ears picked up the stealthy sound of something moving, not behind her, but in front, somewhere beyond the mill and the ceramic shop. There was plenty of movement out there. The wind on this slope was so strong that the trees were always talking and rustling in their own secret language, but these were not tree noises. Slow and clumsy, but purposeful. The sounds getting closer. Katie heard the sharp crack of a disturbed branch snapping back into place. "Roe?" she asked faintly. The sound barely left her lips, and she was glad. She might not have any gifts. She couldn't see in the dark like Gavin, or move with the quick animal silence of Lear, but her intuition worked as well as anyone's. And what she heard out there was bad. Not Roe's kind of bad, charming and seductive, but something terrible. Katie thought longingly of her knife, still sitting on her dresser next to a pile of clothing. They weren't supposed to wear their knives anywhere but practice, but Katie would have given anything to have a blade with her now. There was no hope for it. She turned and began walking up the path into the woods, tucking her head, trying to step quietly, determined not to look backward. The woods would be bad, but she could manage. She was 15 years old. The path was longer than Roe's shortcut, but at least it was a way that Katie knew. She wouldn't get lost. She would walk back up to town and crawl into her own bed, and the next time Ro came knocking, she would keep her window shut. Even in the dark, she made decent progress. The tree cover was thick, but enough moonlight shone down through the gaps in the branches that Katie could pick her way along. Despite her best intentions, she kept glancing behind her, but she saw nothing. Whatever it had been, and she had no intention of dwelling on that question, not until she was safe in her bed and the sun had risen and flooded the town with light, it hadn't followed her up here. The path curved. Ahead of her, Katie saw a wide break in the trees giving onto a broad, levelled field. Moonlight limned the field clearly, revealing the dark, rounded shapes of tombstones. The graveyard. The town, worried about contaminating the water supply, had always buried its dead near the bottom of the hill. William Tyr encouraged cremation. He and Roe agreed on that, at least. But there were too many people whose religious faith demanded that they go into the ground. The last time the subject had come up at meeting, Paul Anscott had rallied a large contingent of Christians. They had won the vote to keep the graveyard and won it fairly. But for a moment, Katie hated them all. That wide expanse of field glowed ghostly in the moonlight. But it was the markers that bothered Katie most. Bad enough to put people in the ground to rot, did they have to commemorate it as well? A branch snapped behind her. Katie whirled around. Through a tiny hole in the foliage, almost impossibly distant, she could see the dim lights of the lower bend. But the portion of the path she had just traversed was a long carpet of shadow. Her heart thundered in her ears, but even over its wild pounding she could hear that sound again, the stealthy push of branches being moved out of the way, something coming toward her, but on the right or the left? "Row!" she screamed into the woods, her throat raw with fright. "If this is you, I'll fucking kill you!" There was no answer, only that same sound of approaching progress, measured and deliberate. Katie dropped to the ground and began scrabbling, digging through the dirt until she found what she sought, a good-sized rock, smooth and rounded but heavy. A rock she could wield. One side was jagged, a geode perhaps, its crystals broken through the rock's cracked surface. Katie straightened, clutching the rock in her hand, then froze as something moved on the path, perhaps 30 feet away, covering a patch of moonlight and blocking it out. It was big. Whatever it was, the height of a tall man. Katie could just make out a hint of silhouette, rounded shoulders and the protrusion of a head, but the shape, the posture were wrong, slumped over, almost as though it was crouching. In desperation, her mind tried to convince her one last time that it was Ro having her on. But Katie knew better. Her gut knew better. She could smell the thing, dank and rotten, like vegetables gone bad in the cooler. It stood still, regarding her silently. And in that silence, Katie felt menace. Not the charged, barely contained menace of a wolf or other wild animal, but something much worse. A thinking menace. Katie was suddenly certain that it knew who she was, that it had come looking specifically for her. "It knows my name," Katie thought, and her nerve broke. She turned and fled. Whatever it was quick. Branches whipped and cracked behind Katie with the speed of its passage. Katie heard her own gasping breath tearing in and out of her throat, but beneath that she heard the thing behind her not breathing, but snarling, a low buzzing noise like the wind made when it crossed the pinwheels in front of the school. Katie wasn't used to running uphill. She sensed that it was gaining. She ran through the lumber site, sprinting now, laying herself out, hearing a clatter of metal and wood as the thing behind her knocked aside one of the logging stations. She chanced to look back, hoping that it had gone down, but the thing was still behind her, even closer than before, a black shadow that loped along, bent low to the ground. The tree cover thinned, and Katie bit back a scream as she glimpsed white flesh and staring eyes, hands that felt along the ground like those of an animal. It was a man, but not a man, not with its spine bent that way, and that inhuman buzzing in its throat. Bad, Katie thought. I know what bad looks like, and there it is, and will it eat me? Is that where this ends? Then the trees closed again, and Katie was back into the deep woods. Her breath rasped inside her throat like sandpaper. She leapt over the trunk of a fallen tree, its branches reaching up to scrape at her legs, but she barely felt it. She kept her eyes on the path, dimly visible ahead of her, knowing that if she blundered into the woods, she was lost. The line of the path was becoming clearer in front of her, a long, light groove in the night, limned in blue. Yes, now she could see everything. If she hadn't been so scared, she might have laughed, because Gavin wasn't the only one who'd received night vision in the crossing. But a moment later, she realized that it wasn't night vision. The light was coming from her right hand, which was still clenched around the rock she had picked up. Tiny blue lines of light gleamed between her fingers, bright enough to illuminate the path. The thing behind her snarled, and Katie screamed because it was right on her. Its voice had been right there, behind her left ear. Something grabbed her hip and squeezed, and she shrieked, a sound like the town fire bell, and now she broke free through the tree line, and there glimmering in the distance was the town, in all of its dull, communal glory. But now Katie was dying to embrace that dullness. If she could have found the town's stolid, thudding heart, she would have kissed it right now. She chanced another glance behind her, and came to a halt. Such an abrupt halt that she fell sprawling in the dirt, scraping the skin from her left elbow. Nothing was behind her. The tree line was perhaps 100 feet back from where she had fallen, right at the bottom of the high road where the houses began, and street lamps glimmered merrily in the dark. The trees at the edge of the woods were rustling, but it was only the natural sound that Katie had heard all of her life, leaves and branches rubbing together in the wind that came off the plains. There was no sign of anything moving. "Katie?" She rolled, gasping, drawing the rock back, prepared to throw it even though she was on her belly. The blue light had faded now. Had it even been there at all? But the lamps were still flickering, and she didn't need extra light to recognize Ro, standing several feet up the high road, not a hair out of place. "Katie, what happened to you?"
"Ro!"
She pulled herself to her feet, sobbing, and flung herself at him.
"Where were you?"
"I went back up on my shortcut, and all of a sudden I looked around and you weren't there. What happened?" Crying, Katie told him. Ro kept his arms around her, but there was something distant about the embrace. And a few minutes into her story, Katie realized that he wasn't giving comfort. He was simply listening. His face turned away.
"And then I got out of the trees and turned around and there was nothing. It was gone, Ro, but it was there, and..."
"I wouldn't worry about it," Ro replied mildly.
"What?"
Ro turned toward her, and Katie saw that his mouth was crimped upward in a smile, triumphant and cruel. She had seen that smile on Ro's face many times, but never directed at her. and it hurt so much that she pulled free of his arms and backed away, looking up at him with wide, wounded eyes. "I wouldn't worry about it," Roe continued. "In fact, Katie, I'd say you were probably just having a delusion." She gaped at him. But Roe had already turned and trudged away, up the hill. Kelsey broke from the past and found herself trapped in the dark. For a moment, she could not escape her vision, and she rolled, gasping, until she recognized the hard stone floor beneath her. She was still in her cell, and for a long minute all she could feel was blessed relief that she was not back there with Katie, out in the woods. There was no one outside the bars, which was a relief as well. The Red Queen knew about her fugues, but still Kelsey didn't like the idea of being observed. Through the wall at her back, she heard her neighbor working, shuffling paper and what sounded oddly like the scratching of a pen. She still hadn't gotten him, or her, to say a word, but there were occasional silences over there that suggested he might be listening when she spoke. Now, though, there was nothing but that scratching. The rest of the dungeon was silent. Kelsey thought it might be the middle of the night. There was something in her hand, hard and rounded. She blinked for a moment, trying to think what it might be, but she was stumped. She was receiving special treatment now. The page, Emily, had given her a candle and a few matches. Kelsey hesitated to waste one of them, but curiosity was too strong. She felt around on the floor until her fingers encountered the candle, and, after a bit of fumbling, finally lit it. The flame was weak, at hazard from the many draughts that crisscrossed the dungeons, but it was enough for Kelsey to see. And she stared at the object in her hand for a very long time, her mind working, trying to grasp what it meant. She was holding a smooth, oval stone, shot through with blue quartz. Book 2. Chapter 6. Isha. The future cannot be divorced from the past. Trust me, for I would know. The Glynn Queen's words, as compiled by Father Tyler.
Hellcat, time to go.
Isha looked up from her saddlebags. Venner was in her doorway, his long, dour face shadowed with concern.
You have everything?
Yes, sir.
Well, say goodbye to your mother.
She scrambled up. Maman was in the Queen's chamber, changing the bed linen. She did this every 2 days, though no one slept there. For a moment, Isha hung in the doorway, watching Maman work. She would miss Maman, yes, but she longed to be out in the world. The mace had already told her that she was not going all the way to Domain. She would stay in the Almont, with General Hall, and be relatively safe. But she had still been surprised that Maman had given her permission to go. A small nagging voice inside her even wondered if Maman wanted her gone.
Maman, I'm leaving.
Maman dropped the pillowcase she was fighting with and came around the corner of the four-poster bed, her arms open. Maman's face was as composed as ever, but Isha was shocked to see that her eyes were sorrowful. Maman had not looked that way since before they had escaped Dar's house.
"Have you seen something, Maman?"
she asked.
"Have you seen whether we'll bring the Queen back?"
"No, love. I don't know."
"Have you seen something about me?"
Maman hesitated, then said, I see many things about you, Isha. You have grown up too quickly already. But I would be a poor parent if I kept you from a course you're clearly meant to follow.
I'm meant to rescue the Queen.
Maman smiled, but Isha sensed bitterness behind it. You're meant to fight, my girl. Just be careful. You go to a dangerous place. Isha sensed Maman hedging, but could make no sense of these dodgy answers. For a rogue moment she wished that Maman could go with them. But no, that would be disastrous. A woman with Maman's sight would command a heavy price in Mortmain. The mace had said so more than once.
Andalai!
Elston's voice roared outside, making them both jump. Isha grabbed her knife, and they hurried out into the hallway where Elston beckoned.
It's your little one. She's having a fit.
Maman broke into a run. Following into the audience chamber, Isha found Maman bent over Glee, who was in one of her trances. Isha had seen this phenomenon so many times that she found it routine, and was almost amused by the reactions of the men around her who had drawn back from Glee, their faces mirroring a nearly identical superstitious dread.
Poppet? Maman asked. Will you come back to us?
But Glee shook her head vigorously. Her wide eyes roved the room for a moment before fixing on the mace, staring at him so long and raptly that even he looked unnerved.
You seek a prize,
Glee murmured, her tone musing, as though she were working out a problem in her head.
But you will not find it in Demain.
One of the new guards, whose name Isha did not know, crossed himself.
Look to Jin Reach,
Glee told the mace.
Poppet?
Maman put her hands on Glee's shoulders.
Poppet, can you hear me? Jin Reach,
Glee repeated.
But we cannot know. Glee, wake up.
Get her out of here, Lai, the mace growled, before she spooks us all.
Maman gathered Glee up in her arms and carried her down the hall. Isha thought of following them, but did not. She had already said goodbye to Maman. I'm ready to leave, she thought, marveling.
Really ready now?
The mace turned to Arliss.
Are you sure our intelligence is sound?
It's sound,
Arliss replied, exasperated.
You handpicked the girl.
What if they've moved the queen in secret?
They haven't. Not unless it happened in the last 2 days.
Find out.
Arliss got up and headed for his office.
Go through Le Vieux rather than Galen,
the mace called after him.
We'll get quicker answers.
Arliss waved him off. Isha wondered what the mace would do. Glee's visions sometimes ended up empty, meaning nothing. But Isha had never known one of her predictions to actually be wrong. She had never heard of Jin Reach.
El, what do you think?
Elston shrugged.
The little one sees, for certain. But I'll take concrete information over vague any day. I say we head on to Demain like we planned.
The mace nodded.
I agree. We can't miss our window.
He turned to the rest of the room, and Isha found that disturbing phrase, a killer of children, echoing inside her head. She had asked Maman about it, and Maman had said she didn't know. But Isha had seen a different truth in her eyes. Isha had asked Corin where the mace came from, and Corin had said he didn't know. There was a secret here, and Isha was determined to ferret it out.
"All of you who remain here," the mace announced. "Devin is in charge of guard business. All other matters belong to Arliss or Andalai."
At this, Isha's mouth dropped open. The mace, leaving Maman in charge. Several of the guards clearly didn't like it either, but their mutters died under the mace's gaze. Looking around the room, Isha suddenly noticed Pen, standing several feet behind the mace. His eyes were circled dark, but he looked sober. He was armed and dressed for travel, his sword at his hip.
"Have this place ready for our return,"
the mace told the guards.
"We're bringing the queen home. Don't let her find you napping."
But despite the confidence of his tone, the mace still looked troubled. 10 minutes later, when Isha went to fetch her saddlebags, he was still bent over the dining table, staring at a map. It was thrilling to be out in the city after dark. The mace had chosen the quietest hour of the night, after the drunks went to bed but before the early laborers were out, and the streets were nearly empty. But all was not quiet. As they approached the outskirts of the gut, Isha became aware of a growing din, men shouting to each other and the occasional clash of swords.
"What is that?"
Ewan asked. He was riding beside Isha near the back of the troop.
"I don't know."
"It's the creche," said Bradshaw, who was riding on Ewan's other side.
He was a last-minute addition to the guard, but in the end, even the mace had been forced to admit that a magician might make himself useful in a jailbreak. Isha still did not know why the mace had decided to bring Ewan. The three of them, Isha, Ewan, and Bradshaw, existed in a strange twilight, armed but not real guards. And Isha wondered if they would serve the same function on this journey. Essentially ballast. But that was the life of a queen's guard. The queen's safety came first, even if all three of them were nothing more than human shields.
"What's the creche?"
Ewan asked.
"The tunnels beneath the gut. The Caden have gone to work in earnest, clearing the place out."
Ewan still looked confused, but of course he would. How would he even know what the creche was? Now they were close enough that the battle noise echoing from the gut was horrendous. Isha wondered how the people who lived there could stand it, how they got any sleep.
"Why are they working at night?"
Ewan asked. Bradshaw's mouth curled in disgust.
"Because at this hour, there's a better chance of catching the clientele."
Isha grimaced as well. She found herself able to picture the creche with extraordinary clarity. The tunnels, the fleeing men, the torches, red cloaks, all of it was somehow tied up in her head with Dar. Because of all the children down there. All of them in danger.
"Isha?"
She blinked and found that she had brought her horse to a stop. Ewan and Bradshaw were some 10 feet ahead, beckoning her to catch up.
"Isha?"
Ewan asked again. She opened her mouth, meaning to explain this thing to him. After all, Ewan was not a real Queen's Guard either. He knew what it was like to be only halfway part of this world. But no, she could not burden Ewan. His imagination would not extend so far, would not be able to encompass the human ugliness that played out only a few streets away. but Isha's could. And did. To her left, a man screamed, and there was a sound of running footsteps. Isha's temperature was rising, and suddenly she remembered something Glee had said days ago. They turn the corner, and you grasp your chance.
Isha? Are you all right?
She smiled. The guard had turned the corner. Her chance was before her, clear and bright and shining. And she only regretted that she could not apologize to the mace personally, explain to him that this was something she simply had to do. Her hand wandered to the knife at her waist, and she gripped the hilt, feeling something titanic rise inside her. She was not a queen's guard, not really, for she suddenly saw that there were more important things in the world than one woman's life. She had wanted to stride the world, stabbing out evil, had been dreaming of it for months. But she knew that the root of these dreams went back further, all the way back to her childhood. Back to Dar. She had been waiting for this chance her entire life.
Tell the captain I'm sorry. Tell him I had no choice.
Ewan's face pinched in confusion, but Bradshaw asked, "What are you going to do?"
"What the Queen would have done."
Isha turned away and found the memory right behind her eyes, the cages, the soldiers, Glee's face bewildered and frightened behind the bars, Maman screaming. It had felt like the end of the world. And then the Queen had come. She had released Glee from the cage, but there were cages everywhere.
"Child, you can't go in there," Bradshaw protested.
"I'm not a child,"
Isha replied, and knew as she said the words that they were true, that she had finally crossed over that mysterious border in her mind.
"Tell the captain that I'm about the Queen's business."
Ewan's mouth widened in dismay, but before he could say anything more, Isha had grasped her chance and disappeared, deep into the shadows of the gut.
"You, girl."
Kelsey looked up, startled. The voice was a man's, speaking good tear, but she couldn't see the source. She sat cross-legged on the floor, perfectly still. But her brain had been working steadily for the past hour or more, trying to assemble information into a unified theory. She was just starting to get somewhere, something about the sapphires and William Tyr, but at the sound of the man's voice, her thoughts fell into disarray.
"You next door."
It was her invisible cellmate. She went to the bars.
"What?"
"You're the marked queen."
Kelsey raised her eyebrows.
"I suppose so."
"My jailer said your army was destroyed. A massacre. Is it so?"
"Yes,"
she replied, lowering her voice to a whisper. She could hear footsteps now, descending the shallow stairs at the end of the corridor.
"We were heavily outnumbered."
"Did none survive?"
Kelsey did not reply as the footsteps approached and torchlight came around the corner. She had assumed that it was Lona, her new jailer, come for her, but the steps paused at the next cell, and a man's voice said in Mort,
"Up you. You're wanted."
Kelsey leaned through the bars, trying to peek down the corridor as the guard unlocked her neighbor's cell. She could not see much, only the far wall and, after a moment, the back of a man's bald head. He went down the corridor, followed by the shadowy form of his jailer, and the light disappeared behind him. Kelsey retreated to the back wall of her cell and slid down to the floor. She considered lighting her candle again, then discarded the idea, thinking was always easier in the dark. 8 months ago, she had had no magic at all. She had been a young girl with a decent brain, a good education, and a strong conviction that some things were definitely right and others definitely wrong. One sapphire had lain around her neck since her infancy, but it had only been a jewel. She had been royal, perhaps, but not remarkable. Life had been ordinary. She had never felt like a queen. On the journey to New London was when she had felt the first difference. It was early one morning, she remembered, perhaps the day of the hawk, perhaps some other. But everything had begun to change from that moment onward. Because she was 19, the age of ascension? It seemed as good an explanation as any, but it still rang false. 19-year-olds were fools, and William Tyr would have known that. They were together, Kelsey recalled suddenly, both sapphires. I held them together in my hands. Could that be it? She didn't know. Where had the second sapphire come from? In Katie's town, two exploration parties had already gotten as far as the foothills of the Fairwitch. Surely one of those parties would eventually come across sapphire in the mountains, where it was nearer to the surface. Easy to make a necklace once you had the raw jewels. Ro Finn was the best metal worker in the town, but by no means the only one. How does this help you? Her mind demanded. All of this history, how has it ever helped? But that voice carried no weight with the adopted daughter of Carlin Glynn. History always mattered. There was a pattern here, and sooner or later it would begin to repeat itself. Both Kelsey and Jonathan Tyr had inherited kingdoms that were falling apart. They were falling apart for different reasons, true, but you're wondering. You've had one of the jewels around your neck since you can remember, so why did it lie there for so many years doing nothing? Perhaps there was nothing to do. This felt right. All of those years she had been hidden in the Reddick, safe in anonymity. Many people had been hunting her, but none of them had found the cottage. If they had, would Kelsey's jewel have lain, meek and quiescent, around her neck? The same jewel that had killed the assassin who dragged her from her bathtub? He was trying to take my necklace off, she remembered. But this fact only seemed to confuse the matter further. Where did such power come from? How could a sapphire act as its own enforcer? Kelsey had given the jewels to the Red Queen of her own free will, but the Red Queen had not been able to use them, though she certainly knew more of magic than Kelsey did herself. Did the jewels have a mind of their own? If so, why choose Kelsey? The Raleighs had worn the jewels for years, but as far as Kelsey knew, there had been no hint of magic about them. She looked up, broken from the run of her thoughts. She had heard something, down the hallway on her left. She had the measure of this dungeon now, and this sound did not belong. A sliding rasp, as though something had scraped the wall of the corridor. There was no other sound, not even from the accused thief up the corridor, and Kelsey realized then that she had not heard from him in days. People probably died in these cells all the time. The Red Queen's page, Emily, came down to check on Kelsey at least twice a day, but these sounds were not hers. Another rasp, this one soft, almost furtive, definitely closer. Something inside Kelsey went cold, and without thinking she reached over to the small pile of provisions by her bedding, feeling around for the rock. Katie's rock. Katie had thought it was blue quartz, but Kelsey had examined it for a long time in the candlelight before deciding that it was sapphire, like those in her necklaces. The same sapphire that seemed to run through the bedrock of the Tearling. It might be easiest to get at in the Fair Witch, but it was everywhere, anchoring her kingdom, shaping the ground beneath the town, and Kelsey had recognized the blue glow lighting Katie's path with no problem at all. But though Kelsey scrabbled on the floor, she could not find the rock, only her matches and the remnants of her last meal. She forced herself to be still. Down the hallway, she heard one footstep, and then another. Soft, as though someone were barefoot, or walking on tiptoe. If they had been carrying a torch, Kelsey would have seen the light by now. Whoever it was traveled in the dark. A cold hand seemed to rest on the back of her neck, making her think of Brenna. Thorn's creature, who could lower the room temperature by her very presence. But Brenna was locked safely away in the keep. The footsteps moved directly in front of her cell, and Kelsey held still, not even breathing, caught in the momentary hope that if she didn't move, no one could find her. The bars thrummed gently, as fingers ran lightly across the front of her cell. Her nerve broke.
"Who's there?"
she asked, then wished she hadn't. There was something terrible about asking questions of the faceless dark. She thought of Katie, calling into the night, and closed her eyes.
"They thought they could keep Pretty from me."
Kelsey froze.
"They thought I wouldn't have my own key."
Kelsey backed up against the wall. She had forgotten about the jailer, and that was a bad misstep. She heard the jingle of a ring of keys, felt the thrum of her pulse racing. "Stay away from me."
"As though Pretty could belong to anyone, except me."
At the words, Kelsey's fear suddenly morphed into anger, beautiful and welcome anger. Vague memories tugged at her, echoes of the day she had ripped Arlen Thorn to pieces. She had promised never to do that again, but now she was ready to jump. The jailer slid his key into the lock, and with the sound of the tumblers falling, Kelsey felt the last of her fear disappear. Fury swelled inside her, bright and shining, until her chest felt twice its actual size. Oh, how she had missed her rage in these past weeks, missed it in a way she would not have imagined possible, and now she felt as though she were reuniting with herself, becoming whole.
"Where is she?"
the jailer mused. This was a game to him, one he had played before. How many prisoners had been forced to endure this? As he moved into the cell, Kelsey suddenly realized that she could see him. A vague figure, cast in a dim blue light. It was the rock. Katie's rock, Katie's sapphire, lying in the corner of the cell, glowing a thin blue. But Kelsey had no time to reflect upon it, for the jailer was moving closer.
"There she is,"
he murmured. His gaze flicked to the corner, marked the glowing piece of sapphire, then seemed to dismiss it. "You do not want to come near me," Kelsey said, speaking slowly. She had meant the words as a bluff, but she also felt a certain truth in them. Something enormous was gathering force inside her. A boulder careening down a hill, picking up speed and power. The jailer pulled a dagger from his waist, and somehow this angered Kelsey most of all. He had at least 50 pounds on her, but still he didn't want even the semblance of a fair fight. She considered various parts of his body and settled on the eyes, visible in the thin blue light. What a pleasure it would be to claw them from his head. No sooner had she thought this than the jailer stumbled, clapping his hand to his eyes. The dagger clattered to the floor, and Kelsey snatched it up. The jailer sank to his knees, howling, and Kelsey darted forward and knocked him over, using her full weight to drive him off his knees and onto the floor. His head clanged against the bars, but Kelsey barely noticed. Whatever had incapacitated him could end at any time, and the urgency of that thought allowed her to straddle him, though she hated to touch him at all, take a good grip on the knife, and bury it in his throat. The jailer groaned and gagged while Kelsey held tight to the dagger's hilt, driving it downward. "No one owns me," she whispered. It went on for a long time, somewhere between 5 minutes and forever, but finally, the jailer's struggles ceased. Feeling the muscle beneath her go slack, Kelsey relaxed. The glow from the rock, if it had even been there at all, had vanished. And Kelsey felt as though her anger had drained away with it. Groping around under the edge of her mattress, she found her matches. The candle took longer, for the struggle had knocked it all the way into the far corner of her cell. When Kelsey finally got it lit, she stood over the man on the floor, staring down at him. She felt very little, only a mild disappointment that she remembered from killing Thorn, and now she heard Andalai's voice, echoing from a dark corner of her memory. "This, I think, is the crux of evil in this world, Majesty. Those who feel entitled to anything they want, anything they can grab." There was the disappointment. Kelsey longed to eradicate true evil, but she could not. All she could do was kill men like the jailer, like Thorn. Men who represented evil's weak and worthless implements. True change danced beyond her grasp. "How do I fix it?" she whispered to the corpse. "How do we get to the better world?" She remained silent, hoping against hope that someone would hear her and answer. William Tyr himself, perhaps, possessed of so much power that his voice might echo across the great twin voids of time and death. But after a moment's thought, she realized that Tyr had already answered her, long ago. There was no quick and easy eradication of evil. There was only the passage of time, of generations, of people raising children who would hold all other lives just as valuable as their own. Tyr had known that was the answer, but even his best efforts had failed. "Because they forgot," her mind answered. "It took them less than a generation to forget everything they should have learned." But that wasn't strictly true. The parents, the generation that had made the crossing, they had deliberately hidden the past from their children. Katie had learned something of world history in her schoolwork, but the brutal period, just before the crossing, the guns, the surveillance, the poverty. Katie had no sense of these things, and neither did her peers. The generation that was beginning to rebel against Tyr's socialism had no familiarity with the flip side of the coin. Tyr had had access to the ultimate cautionary tale. but he had wasted it, allowed the warning to vanish.
But you remember, Kelsey, Carlin whispered. By the end, you might even know it all.
What can I possibly do with that knowledge? There was no answer, only the jailer's face staring up at her. His corneas were a deep, dark red. He had tried to claw his own eyes out. Kelsey cast around for the piece of uncut sapphire and found it still lying in the back corner of her cell. "What are you?" she asked. She began to pick it up, and then froze, feeling her breath halt. The door of her cell was wide open, the jailer's key ring still dangling from the lock. Her first impulse was simply to bolt from the cell, but Kelsey forced herself to hold still, to assess the situation. She had some sense of the layout of the dungeons, but none of the castle beyond. How far would she really get? Don't be a coward. You have an open door. At the thought of the tearling, longing seemed to wrench her heart. She generally avoided thinking of her kingdom in concrete terms. In this dark cell, it seemed like a good way to go mad. But now she closed her eyes and saw the Almont stretching before her, miles of farms and river, and then New London, her city on a hill. Very different from Tears, this city, and sinking just as surely. But there was still good there. When the Mort had reached the city, and they had brought the last refugees inside, the keep had been filled to capacity, and there were still 2,000 people without shelter. They could not sleep in the streets, for the temperature was dropping to freezing at night. Arliss had been at his wit's end, but at the last moment, Kelsey remembered now, the merchants had come forward, the Guild of New London Shopkeepers, and offered to house them all in their homes and shops. Her kingdom might be flawed, but it was still worth fighting for. And more than anything, Kelsey simply wanted to go home. But acting on desire had gotten her into trouble before. Thorne's face flashed before her again. Sometimes Kelsey felt that she would never escape him, and perhaps that was fitting. For when she had killed him, she had been thinking not of the kingdom, but of herself. She could not afford to make such a mistake here. She could not help her kingdom when she was dead, and she was currently alive on the Red Queen's grace. An escape attempt would crush their fragile détente. As much as she wanted to, Kelsey could not simply flee and hope for the best. For her kingdom, she had to stay. She could at least get her jailer's body out of her cell. But another look at him convinced Kelsey of the futility of that. The floor around his corpse was covered with blood. No. They would find him, and they would find him in her cell. There was no way to prevent it. "You have an open door," her mind hectored. "Maybe just a look around," Kelsey whispered, and realized in horror that she was speaking to the jailer as she skirted his corpse to reach the door. "Just a quick look around. See what's what." She tiptoed out of her cell. The corridor to her right was dark, but to her left, far down the hallway, there was a hint of flickering torchlight near the stairs. Otherwise, the long line of cells was still, and she heard no sounds of movement. The jailer had made plenty of noise as he died, but screams were hardly uncommon in these dungeons. It didn't sound like anyone was coming to investigate. Cupping her hand around her candle flame, Kelsey moved toward the light. Even a brief survey of her neighbor's empty cell showed that seniority did have its privileges. The bald man had clearly